proposal that the governor, by a signature at any rate, agrees to?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So it's all right to call it, at least indirectly, the governor's proposal as well as the task force proposal. I'm trying to get to that.
You don't have to do that because it is the governor's task force on subsistence.
Each and every member was appointed by the governor. Byron, one of the things that might have avoided the constitutional amendment were if need were considered in some way as an established method of differentiating among Alaskans with regard to certain rights. And I believe Representative Young and Senator Murkowski sent a letter to the commission on July 23rd suggesting that need be one of the criteria used.
Right.
What was the discussion, and the reason I'm asking this with regard to the constitutional amendment is I think we all know that need would have obviated the need for a constitutional amendment if need had been one of the matrix criteria. What happened to Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young's suggestion?
Their proposal was discussed after some discussion. It was believed that approach was not within the framework of minimal change of trying to come into compliance, recognizing the importance of the October 1st deadline. We also were aware that there is a strong opposition to that notion in the Native community, and we just felt that, you know, that was certainly an appropriate public policy discussion, but it would not allow us to get to a point where we could develop a package. And I think it goes without saying that within the framework of a group of seven like this, we were also trying to maintain the ability to work together, achieve consensus within the group to try to come to a total package. You know, once again, we focused on working within the framework of the existing rural priority.
I was amazed, frankly, that two out of three of our congressional delegation made that proposal. And I was also surprised that it didn't seem to go anywhere from there, because it would have obviated the need for a lot of the rest of the debate and would have truly represented a substantial change. Those two being, of course, the chairs of the substantive committees that would have had to deal with it in both houses of the U.S. Congress.
We did have a discussion with them about this package. I need to say that Congressman Young was not personally involved because he was in hospital at the time. But we discussed it with them, generally indicated where our thinking was, and asked them at that time, recognizing that we just don't believe that we can move forward with the recommendations you've made. Do you think that our work in progress is on the right track, and should we continue? And they indicated a very strong yes.
Just one last question on the constitutional amendment. In committee report on H.R. 39, there was a limitations clause on Section 815, which basically, and it's a long list of things, so I'll read the introductory line that applies to each of the list, and then I'll read the list. But this section provides that nothing in this act is intended to be construed as, and then it says granting any property right and subsistence, and it goes on through all these things. And it also says, and I'll read it together, this section provides that nothing in this act is intended to be construed as amending the Alaska Constitution. I wonder what Congress meant by that. And if you'd have any, I mean, you were involved in that process. We were, a number of us were involved in that process. And I wonder what Congress was thinking when they said, nothing in this act shall be construed as amending the Alaska Constitution. At least our delegation knew about the provisions in our Constitution and were vitally and directly involved in completely in drafting this committee report.
I can speak personally only with a vague recall because I can remember discussions with the Attorney General at the time, Avram Gross, other members of the state administration under Governor Hammond, who had grave concerns about the native priority language, had grave concerns about this being Indian legislation, and at least with respect to the preference being native, obviously said that this is unconstitutional with reference to the state constitution. My own, and this isn't a recollection, it would be a supposition that after having being told quite forcefully by the state that the native priority is not acceptable, but a rural one might be, that there was a general acceptance that that would not require an amendment to the state constitution. And so it would not, on that basis, surprise me that such language would get into either the report or in some other document. But that's just a layman's view and a supposition, Mr. Chairman.
But there was at least some debate going on in the state at the time as to the constitutionality of those provisions, was there not?
Absolutely.
Other questions on the constitutional amendment? Yes.
One last thing.
Senator Tilly.
You will get back to me and to the committee, I hope, with opinions from someone on all three of those issues, the three being, does this so change the equal protection clause that it overcomes the concerns of McDowell? I think that's a simple one. The second one is, does this so change the equal protection clause that it does allow for this racial selection process in tribal councils? And does this, in fact, impact the question of sovereignty and native country to the extent that it is a recognition by the state of that entity for nomination purposes? I think those are important. And the only sidebar on that one is fourth one, and that is, does this and could this impact the very there's very specific language in Pittman Roberts' Wallet Row funding on what you can and cannot do. You cannot distribute it based upon some sort of racial basis. And it appears to me as though you're getting awfully close to that line, and I would just like some authority that says, oh, don't have to worry about that one. It's fine.
I will bring those issues to the Department of Law through Mr. Mason. I have no authority to get them to act, but I will raise them.
One other question that's come up that should be on that list, and that is a definition of other renewable natural resources.
Oh, yeah.
Because that, I'd like to know what we're putting in the Constitution, and if that is a term of art that's been used before, I'd like to know what it means. And we have Representative Williams on the teleconference would like to speak, and then we'll go to Jewel. Bridget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Byron, good afternoon, and doesn't this remind you of some of our dissident shareholders meetings?
I've had good training for these kinds of sessions, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, I have also. Byron, I have been asking different people this question all the time, and they keep telling me that it doesn't mean anything. And I says, well, I'm going to keep asking until I get an answer. And it has to do with the one of the things that I've found out during my time in trying to find solutions to problems is finding out where that problem started. Subsistence didn't just happen. It didn't just happen because somebody thought that the Alaska Natives should have subsistence, a priority. It wasn't because Governor Hammond said that in 1978 or whenever it was that the Natives have to be taken care of, and so we're going to have a subsistence clause in ANILCA. In the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the way I understand it, and I've been doing my research on this issue, is that subsistence was part of the negotiated settlement. And if we all remember, for those of us that were here during the time, 1971, that the pipeline was going to be put through. We needed to have the pipeline, we needed to have the land freeze lifted so that we can start building a pipeline. And in order for us to get the land freeze lifted, we had to have this Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Myron, you were part of this at that time. I would like to know what your thoughts are on, was this part of a negotiated settlement? And what does this conference report that was printed December 13, 1971, and in it, it says that on the other issues, sea of other issues, I'll read the last paragraph. The conference committee expects both the secretary and the state to take any action necessary to protect the subsistence needs of the natives. And we all know that the state and the secretary tried to take care of the subsistence needs of the natives, but to no avail, as you all know. Back in 1975, things were trying to happen in the legislature, and also in 1978. And then in ANILCA, it reads this also. In order to fill the policies and purposes of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as a matter of and as a matter of equity, it is necessary for the Congress to invoke its constitutional authority over Native affairs and its constitutional authority under the Property Clause and the Commerce Clause to protect and provide the opportunity for continued subsistence uses on the public lands by Natives and non-Natives, rural residents, and goes on. Byron, let's say that there was a settlement, and this was part of that settlement. Would we be having this discussion today if we were, and would we be hearing from Senators Murkowski and Stevens, and Representative Young, telling us to have a constitutional amendment done because they didn't want to go back on their word? They made a deal back in 1971. Am I reading that correctly?
My recollection, and I concur with much of the historical perspective that you've provided, except, of course, Senator Murkowski was not there then. The reason that subsistence was not dealt with in ANCSA itself was, if I recall, during conference, a clear recognition that both, or a belief on the part of conferees, that particularly the secretary, but also very likely the state of Alaska, already had the requisite authority, and in the person of the secretary, the responsibility to provide for the subsistence needs of Alaska's native people. And so it was recognized in ANCSA. It was one of those issues that was left to administrative discretion, but with clear intent in the ANCSA debate and in the conference report that it would be maintained and dealt with responsibly as a significant public policy of the United States. And it was dealt with in statute, federal statute, in ANILCA in 1980 for reasons that we've all discussed here already. The reference to the Commerce Clause and so forth that are in the language of ANILCA are recognition that in many ways this was being responsive to a specific Alaska Native need, but it also includes other Alaskans and, you know, the entire framework of those acts bring us to where we are today. My understanding of the role of Senators Murkowski and Young and Stevens is that they are working with us to try to accommodate that role based upon their perceptions of the issue. And in our discussion, again, at least on this package of linked ANILCA amendments, state statutes, and a draft constitutional amendment, that the congressional delegation has not formally concurred with this package, but they have indicated that the ANILCA, proposed ANILCA amendments are doable and that they would seek their passage.
I guess what I'm trying to do is to get away from some of this rhetoric that we're going through all the time and saying that we are compromising our rights. Wasn't our rights compromised in ANCSA? Was that part of the negotiated settlement then? And if it was, then should we live up to that settlement?
Well, certainly ANCSA, with the Congress acting in its plenary authority with respect to Native Americans, did abolish hunting and fishing rights as part of the Settlement Act, but was very clear to recognize the importance of subsistence as a remaining and continuing public policy duty of the federal government.
That abolishing of titles in hunting and fishing was a property right. It was not an individual right.
That's absolutely right.
Again, Byron, I guess what I'm trying to find out is, was it part of the negotiated settlement of ANCSA?
It was part of the negotiated settlement to ANCSA to the extent that there has been a continuing federal recognition as to its importance, a sense of federal obligation, the passage of federal statute on this subject, that indeed the federal government felt that it was so important that it was willing to assume the exercise of management of fish and game resources on public lands in Alaska should the state not choose to be in compliance with those federal imperatives.
Representative Obie.
Thank you. Representative Williams, we seem to go around the Mary Bush a lot on this issue, and I'd like just to, Native Claims Settlement Act was a settlement, and that's the operative word, and in exchange for 44 million acres, including the subsurface rights, $1 billion, close to $1 billion, approximately half of which the state paid in cash, all Aboriginal titles, if any, claims of Aboriginal title, based on use and occupancy, including submerged land underneath all water areas, both inland and offshore, including any Aboriginal hunting or fishing rights that may exist, are hereby extinguished. And in the declaration of policy in the Act, it says that it should be settled rapidly, with certainly in conformity, with no racially, without establishing permanently racially defined institutions. So, you know, I guess I'm confused why we keep talking about the conference committee report. As we know, the conference committee is part of the legislative record that's built. As legislation is passed, what is passed is enacted into law is what is law. And, you know, ANILCA has been recognized. I remember reading, I can't remember who the solicitor, but a solicitor general of the Department of Interior had said that ANILCA is recognized as remedial Indian legislation. So anyway, I guess that's the only comment I have.
Mr. Chairman, I could go along with that, but it does say in ANILCA, in order to fulfill the policies and purposes of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So something was done in that area. It recognized, apparently, ANILCA recognized the deal that was made in ANSCA. And if we're trying to go back on a deal that was made, then let's talk about that. Maybe I'm not hearing it correctly, like I said before. Tell me where I'm wrong. But what I see today is that there was a settlement that was agreed to by the United States Congress and the state of Alaska and the Alaska Natives. The pipeline went through. We had our 44 million acres of land and $900 million, but subsistence has not been yet taken care of yet. So what do we do about that? Or am I wrong? Where am I wrong? And Representative Vogan, if you can show me where that information that you just read, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'd rather hear from the people they came to testify instead of us getting into a protracted debate over it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jewell.
Thanks. Had the governor not appointed the task force to work on this issue, do you feel that as many people who have a stake in this issue would be discussing the issue today?
I would assume that there would be activity taking place. And as I indicated earlier, at least my personal expectation, not expectation, but I guess I hadn't really thought about it in detail, my sense was that this was such an important issue, the notion of the public policy desire of the state of Alaska to reclaim fish and game management on all lands in our state, that would precipitate a full-scale effort to try to resolve the issue. And I thought, and this was a personal sense without discussing it with anyone, that this subsistence task force would be just one among a number of efforts. I don't see how we otherwise would have not, you know, made a lot of efforts to deal with it.
Oh, do you see, then I guess this proposal as a tool to bring stakeholders to the table.
Most stakeholder groups have indicated that they believe this could have been a more open process. Some have been even less charitable. But I do know for certain that we could not have come up with a middle ground, and I have to say exactly that's what it is, kind of an approach if it had been an open stakeholder process. If there were another bill out there someplace, I think that, you know, the stakeholders should be looking at that. If there is any way at all that we can bring the stakeholders together, at least to the same table, and begin trying to craft a solution, I just think that that we ought to be doing that. For example, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about this package from various stakeholder groups, but not in a substantive form, you know, not in a section-by-section review, not in looking at it as a whole piece. And, you know, as one way of furthering this effort, and I certainly applaud the efforts of the legislature holding these hearings, but, you know, if there were a structured way that the stakeholders could spend time with this document, and if there are other issues out there that they could get their arms around, for example, Senators Murkowski and Young's proposal, think there are other ideas out there, but some mechanism that would bring those folks that really haven't been talking to one another to try to work on something that could lead to a resolution, I think that is something that is very badly needed, and quite frankly, that was the reason for our effort.
Thank you. If we're done with the constitutional amendment, let's try and do a 15-minute read-through of the ANILCA provisions. If there are questions, let's try to make them short, and let's try to get to the testimony. The ANILCA provisions do need to be gone through, but hopefully we can go through them as rapidly as possible. My questions, just so you know ahead of time, the changes on page 4 with regard to customary and traditional that were made in the very end, and I would like to know, of the ANILCA changes, which ones deal with the Paratrovich case, the limitation on commercial sales, which ones deal with the Bobby case, the limitation and the definitional change between least adverse impact versus reasonable opportunity, those kinds of things that have been ANILCA problems for the last 15 years. But, and Byron, if you'd rather have... If he can do it fast, whichever one of you can do it faster so that we can go to the public testimony, because I know people want to testify. It's just hard when this really hasn't been in print before us except this week.
Mr. Chairman, I'm anxious to be away from this table. on page 4, Mr. Chairman, and I'll ask...
Okay, page 4 of the packet. I think everybody has this packet or the packet's available at the back.
Customary and... traditional, once again, this is essentially what is in state statute. I think we may have modified it to some degree, and its purpose was to get this definition into the federal law so that there would be, as is the case with all of these, the desire was to get these definitions into federal law so that hopefully we could avoid opportunities for litigation and other difficulties having to do with their definitions. So
a specific question with regard to customary and traditional. At the last meeting, just a few days before this was printed, the conjunction was changed from an and to an or, which changed the previous meant customary and traditional means the non-commercial, long-term, and consistent taking of, use of, and reliance upon. That was the previous language. It was changed to or reliance upon, which meant that the window of customary and traditional opened up to any one of instead of all of those criteria. I wonder what the debate was on that, because that is not the state statutory provision is much narrower than that.
I recall my sense of it was that it was ministerial.
There was a open meeting of the group, a public meeting of the group in Fairbanks after it spoke with the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. And my memory of that was that, I don't remember who raised it, but that not all people who are engaging in subsistence uses take, use, and rely on, and that was the reason for changing and to or, to recognize that some people take and some use but don't take.
But this is changing the federal mandate statute to make it a stronger mandate on the state than the existing mandate on the state. Or, no, than the existing state definition. I mean, the debate was that the state definitions were going to go into federal law. This is adding to the mandate, basically.
That was not our intent, Mr. Chairman. And I recall the discussion now that it was Fish and Game Department staff discussion to some meaningful degree, but that wasn't our intent. Certainly, I commend it to your attention.
Is it the intent of this section to limit cash sales and cash trade? And if so, to what extent? That the existing, you know, court determination was $15,000 per person in sale of roe-on kelp, aggregate value $70,000, defended by subsistence outside of the regulatory structure in violation of the otherwise regulatory structure. What is the line going to be?
Are we talking about customary trade now?
Yes.
Our whole discussion had to do with, you know, non-commercial means non-commercial, and that it should be limited, and that we knew that this was a very contentious area, and I think our consensus as a group was that it would be very strictly limited.
So it's your intent that it be?
That it be strictly limited. And that
number, 5,000 instead of 15,000 per person, 20,000 for a family instead of 70,000 for a family, what are we gaining?
We had some discussion on this and believe that it was best left to the discretion and the regulatory responsibilities of the boards of fish and game, because what number might work in one place might not work in another. But we very clearly in our discussions meant for this to be highly restrictive, and I guess that's all I can say. And if
any other questions?
On that point, Mr. Chairman, does this apply also to the INANILCA, the Subsistence Advisory Board? I know that they're advisory to the other boards, but is this a province of the Subsistence Board? You hear what I'm saying?
Yes. I mean,
would they determine not only what the subsistence needs are in particular regions of the state, but and what regulations ought to be imposed, but also what values of customary trade or commercial sale?
Those would be the responsibilities of the boards of fish and game by regulation. The subsistence councils have the ability to recommend to the boards. Do not have to accept that. The ultimate responsibility rests with the boards of fish and game. But it is very clear that the subsistence regional councils can make recommendations and opine on those regulations. And can even recommend.
On the same issue. I think we talked about this before in a previous meeting, that on page 48, that under the state law, that this was to, since this wasn't defined in ANILCA, that this was intended to mirror the state statute in IE on page 48, line 11, that it's as restricted by the appropriate board. So I think that was the intent, as I understood it from a previous, maybe, Julian, you were the one that answered that. I don't
referred to that. Under the state scheme, customary trade, or determining what is non-commercial is done by the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game. The ANILCA definition on page 4 doesn't have as restricted by the appropriate board, because the reg-making power is, in fact, found in page 25, which is in section 8.
And again, that was just one of those ministerial issues, Mr. Chairman, where we transferred some of the state language to AMNILCA, we did in some of our early drafts incorporate that rulemaking authority and didn't have it in others, and finally just said find a consistent place to put the rulemaking authority and have it referred to wherever it needs to refer to.
But the result is that we have two different definitions subject to a court's interpretation. That's what we were trying to avoid.
I don't think that's a problem, but it wouldn't offend anybody on the committee if someone were to add here as restricted by the appropriate board. It was purely a feeling on the committee that it's better just put the rulemaking authority in a broad form clause to just stick it in each place it occurs. It's just that simple.
For example, if I recall, a brief discussion we had was, you know, there might be a reason to, at some point, define customary trade in statute. And
both ANILCA and state, it should be defined in statute.
And, but that's not the case now. And once again, Mr. Chairman, our goal was to try to live with as little change to the system as exists as was possible. But our concern was that if we, limited the rulemaking scope in the federal statute, that could hamper state management. So we were just trying to deal with that.
Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to this customary and traditional part, I'd like to know if your group took into consideration the changes that have been done, you know, throughout the whole state from 1920 to 1997 as far as your definition of what is customary and traditional, and for taking the game and fish with the advanced technologies that we have today. Is there going to be bag limits, regulations, so that they can't just go and fish and hunt whenever they please with our advanced technology, you know, and consideration of conserving and protecting the resource? Also, if you could just let me know if you took that into consideration, because we don't live back in 1920s anymore out in the bush. It's changed a lot, and the technology has changed. Have you thought about that during your meetings that you've had?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, all of this management structure works within the constitutional requirement of sustained yield. And we know that the boards and the department and the legislature over the years have structured a management system that has been, I was going to say well proven, let me just say that at least has been proven and has worked on the ground, and that these terms do have meaning in present law, in present regulation, in present management, and we did not. And as I said earlier, we wanted to make minimal changes. And we did have some discussion about this very issue, for example, briefly over, you know, what is a reasonable period of time, because we wanted to recognize that even things that are customary and traditional evolve. They aren't fixed in time. They aren't fixed in belief. They aren't even fixed necessarily in value. But they do evolve, and it was our desire to be responsive to that and believe that current law, current regulation, as has been practiced and has defined these terms, did that. And so we were comfortable that the kinds of issues that you raised were dealt with.
To follow up on that point, too, Mr. Chairman, have you taken into consideration the many Alaska Natives that live in Anchorage and Fairbanks and, say, Willow, Palmer, Wasilla, Juneau? You know, those that are not in the rural areas, they have, if they're claiming cultural and traditional and customary ways, under statutes and all the changes that are going to be made, they're going to be left out of going back to hunt and fish in the area that they came from. It's just like me. I grew up in Anzac, and I moved to Willow in 1986, but I can't go back there and hunt and fish.
We spent a lot of time discussing this. I was a strong proponent in our first meeting, for example, of exactly what you were discussing. There were several members who were very strongly opposed to the notion of rural plus. I guess that's the definition that this has been given. And I acquiesced. And we moved on. We have even moved to the point that, that in order to qualify for subsistence in this package, that an individual must be a resident domiciled in the area, in the community or area in which a subsistence resource is taken. We tried to deal with that prohibition at least in a modest way by expanding the proxy provision in state statute without impacting the resource or the subsistence priority by allowing a family member, immediate family member, of a qualified subsistence user who might live in an urban area to come to the rural area to take a subsistence resource on behalf of a qualified subsistence user who would not then be able to exercise that opportunity. We restricted it by saying that the majority of the resource taken had to remain in the subsistence area. So we know that this is an issue. We tried to be responsive to it through the proxy process, but we know it's a tough issue.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, on this issue of the proxy system as well. Seems like you're trying to extend and give privileges in this manner to individuals. I don't think that we should continue on that portion because everyone should be treated as Alaskans and not say, oh, you'll get a proxy because you're living in this area, but it should be an open-ended system to where everyone would qualify instead of going through a proxy system. And I bring that point up because Anchorage probably has the most native, the highest population of Native people living right here in this big city here, but they can't go back and hunt and fish and from where they came from. And I also think that with this, the NILCA amendments, you're asking us to go ahead and change our state constitution, and it's like getting into quicksand because once you're there, you can't get out of it. We'll change it, but yet the way this package is put together, it clearly does not answer a lot of serious concerns that are going to come up regarding everybody in the state. And everyone is saying, well, it's not a Native issue. It's not going to be based on who you are or where you're from, but from looking at it and reading it, it clearly does say it is a Native issue, and that's what the big fight about. Fight of it all is, the federal government is mandated to care about the Native people, but there's more to it than this issue here. I think the state clearly should be given the right to choose and decide on how we're going to manage our fisheries here. After all, it's a resource that's been granted by Mother Nature for everybody, and the way this is all going on, and everybody's saying, well, we're spending too much money on these hearings and stuff. But until the Native people are going to realize that, we are in 1997 today, we can move forward if we work together, but we can't continue to say we need this, we need that, it's our right, because we're all Americans here, and if we're going to continue down this path, giving proxies and talking about customary and traditional, which would maybe relate back to the 1920s, but not to today. We have to try to protect it and enhance it, but at the same time move forward and look into the 20 years from now, where are we going to be? Has this proposal looked at the long-term part of it?
Let's try to come back to that. Is the proxy system part of the federal mandate changes in Anilka?
No, it's not.
Okay, let's do the proxy system questions if we get to the state statute. Because as long as we're not adding to the federal mandate and increasing the things that you have to do in state statute to comply in the proxy system, at least that's a decision that will be made at home amongst the last of us.
In any event, Mr. Chairman, I just comment very briefly that the proxy system already exists in state law, and once again, we were trying to make minimal changes to an existing law in order to...
That's a proposal that only applies to state law. That's probably the least damaging of any kind of proposal you could make, because it's up for consideration always at a state level.
Right.
So if we can go on with just those things that we're changing in the mandates in Anilka, if there's questions on those things, let's... Reggie, did you have a question on Anilka? You're on page 4. We've gone through customary trade, customary and traditional. The next big one is on page 5.
Mr. Chairman, the state standard is reasonable opportunity. We had, or we recognized, and had called to our attention in written submissions that the Native community at least believe that the current standard is least adverse impact, and that that should be the standard, and that for the task force to act differently would result in a diminution of the federal priority. On balance, after again keeping within the framework of wanting to develop a package that had minimal change from existing state statute, we stayed with the reasonable opportunity standard. We recognized that it was contentious, that it had led to a lot of disagreement over the application of the subsistence priority. And we felt it was important and appropriate to include that in the federal definition.
So this is intended to reverse the least adverse impact standard that's pretty much expressed through the Bobby case. I guess that's probably as
uses reasonable, uses opportunity often throughout the document, and it was kind of that framework in which I made my decision, and I can't recall a discussion that we, as the task force members, had any specific discussion or maybe even general discussion of the Bobby case.
Just reading from the, I think all the members have the packet from our legal division, and they cite the Bobby case, and they quote, basically Judge Holland said, must first eliminate other consumptive uses before restricting customary and traditional uses of game for subsistence purposes. So you have to have had entire elimination. And I assume it's the intent of the task force that a reasonable opportunity doesn't mean a year-round season if, when equipped with a dog team, it might have taken a year-round season to harvest one moose per family, but now equipped with snow machines and four-wheelers, it takes 30 or 45 or 60 or 90 days to harvest one moose per family.
That is certainly not our intent, Mr. Chairman. We believe that reasonable opportunity should have a plain meeting, but we believe that the boards can provide that, that this is based on sustained yield, that the history of subsistence taking and use has been one of only in rare instances precluding other uses of the same resource, and to the maximum degree possible, we want that to continue.
Question. Next.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to federal land, if there are any questions or if you'd like a brief explanation, Mr. Mason can give it. I have got to admit that as a lay member of this task force, that there were some of these definitional issues a lawyer might not understand, but there were times when I just kind of went to sleep.
Well, what's going on here is that the definition of federal land, first, all the definitions for Title 8 of Anoka, with one or two exceptions, are not in Title 8 of Anoka, they're somewhere else. The definition of federal land requires going through roughly four pages, which have been reprinted here. They're actually in Title 1 of Anoka. Some of the people in the task force wanted the definition of what federal land really was to show up in one place. This is the result. There is actually a flaw in this. You need to strike or native corporation and state land selections and decline in subsection 3A and B below. However, it was not the intent of this to change any definition, and it was not the intent of this to overturn Katie John or anything like that. It was simply an effort to, probably a failed one, but an effort to make the definition of federal land appear all in one place instead of having to pour through a bunch of sections. It's not meant to change anything.
So it's not intended to exclude state land, state navigable waters from the definition of federal public land or public land that appears throughout Anoka.
Well, state land already is, but the problem, we're going to illustrate the problem for ourselves. Land is defined as lands, waters, and interests therein already. It's not meant to change the current definition of federal land, which includes waters. It does nothing.
Senator Taylor.
It appeared to me from the map you distributed in Fairbanks that through this classification, you would recognize, and to that extent, I guess, limit, but recognize a federal definition, which I thought was still just being argued for by the federal government, as including reserves regarding navigable.
Well, the map is simply a document prepared by the Interior Department to show the scope of the regulations that it will propose. If we didn't do it, it has nothing to do with this proposal. It simply shows the scope of what the feds will claim to be reserved navigable waters.
And we might challenge a number of those in the process.
But we can't if, in fact, we adopt their definition.
Yeah, let me tell you, this definition was not intended to change anything. It was meant to corral pieces of the definition that go on for three or four pages. It would please me if it were not here. I mean, just me personally, because I think to some extent it confuses things by trying to do that. But what the committee wanted to do, because in order to figure out what federal land means and whether it includes state land, you have to look somewhere else. It does not.
My only concern is that, and I think I share your concern about having it here and having it cause further confusion, I don't want to see us in any way forfeit an opportunity to challenge some of the definitions regarding waters that have been proposed by the federal government and appear on that map. I think there are several of those that the state, I hope, still wishes to debate and discuss with the federal government, especially as far as reserves regarding navigable waters. I just don't want to see us doing anything in here that that would forfeit that and give up that opportunity to assert what states' rights we have left in those lawsuits.
Well, that was certainly not, I can assure you, that was not the intent. Absolutely.
You'd recommend deletion of it?
Well, if I could sort of take off my task force hat for a minute, put on my lawyer hat, I think it leads to confusion to repeat definitions that are elsewhere, and I'd rather have it out, because then I don't run into arguments about what it means since it repeats something. Yeah. I'll put my other hat back.
Okay, back on your other hat, have we included other definitions within this packet which might result in the same outcome from what I fear?
I don't believe so. No, sir.
Thank you.
Go on to Section 805, the regional system and the changes to the existing law. It looks like we're adding to the federal mandate. This is one that, in a way, is easier to talk about by looking at the state statutory amendments, but let me talk about where it is. The state statutory amendments propose regional councils, regional subsistence councils, which are required currently by ANILCA. The regional subsistence councils that the task force proposed are constituted a little differently than the way they are constituted under ANILCA. Therefore, if you use the task force proposal for regional subsistence council requires some amendment of ANILCA, and that's what this amendment is. You want to stick with the regional subsistence councils constituted as dictated by ANILCA. Okay, but the point is you're amending the mandate. Why don't we just amend the state law and leave the mandate as simple as it is? Anytime you add to a mandate, it seems that you're adding to the dictates of the federal government to us.
The reason is that, for example, there was commentary received by the task force that it would be wise to have people who use a resource but who are not resident in the region, they should have a voice on regional subsistence councils. They cannot under ANILCA, because ANILCA requires that all members be from the region. The task force recognized that and put it in state law, but you wouldn't be able to implement that, as the state law would not be consistent with ANILCA unless you amended ANILCA to accommodate that.
So why didn't you simply include the amendment that said shall be composed of residents of the region and, which is also part of your amendment, and delete all the additions that you're making? Wouldn't that be a lot simpler?
I'm sorry, I just didn't understand the question.
Well, all you have to do is delete shall be composed of residents of the region in the existing federal law and not add a mandate for all the rest of the details of these sport and commercial and maybe residents of subsistence resource and recommended by tribal councils and recommended from nominees by local governments and local advisory committees. Three of the six shall be subsistence users. Three shall be sport or commercial users. I mean, why are we adding and complicating a federal mandate?
Chairman, I was asleep when this happened. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be glib. Absent the rationale as to why we did put it in there, I would tend to agree with you that if we wanted to make the change to accommodate what we have recommended, the only real change in federal statute would be repeal that phrase that says shall be composed of residents of the region, because we did believe that it was appropriate to have some wider coverage or participation, but that's all I can say on that subject.
Further questions on the regionalization? Sarah Lincoln.
how would you propose to change it then if you don't have residents of the region? How do you determine? Just shall be, what would the words be?
Each regional advisory council shall have the following authority.
So you wouldn't even say what the composition of
Not in the federal mandate. You could still deal with it in state statute, however you were going to go through the process at the state legislative level to decide. But you wouldn't add it to a federal mandate against yourself.
There's absolutely no question, Mr. Chairman, that the whole discussion surrounding whether or not the subsistence council language should be incorporated into the federal statute had everything to do with our desire to have out-of-region representation in the federal statute not allowing that or specifically prohibiting it and wanting to deal with that.
Senator Sharp, further questions? Let's go on to 806.
There are two things at work here. One is the linkage. Again, how you link is going to be a function of how one links is a function of what goes first. That's really the first half. The point of the first half is to say that if the state does its part, then it immediately resumes fish and game management. That's not some period of litigation or something like that. The second half is to make it clear that it requires a court as distinct from the Secretary of Interior to say that the state is out of compliance. That, at least up until now, is an open issue.
So we're congressionally in compliance, and it will take another court case to be back out of compliance.
That's right. For example, if the state were to begin managing and were to take some action that somebody thought put the state out of compliance, then it would take litigation, not simply a decree of the Secretary of the Interior.
Good questions on 806? No questions on 806. 807? Response, what it is?
To make sure that the federal courts, if they're reviewing actions of the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game, treat them with respect to their.
Okay, the next change is, 813, one of the smaller provisions. Anytime the state's in compliance, it just says that the regionalization scheme of the feds doesn't apply when the regionalization scheme of the state is in place. Is that correct?
You said 813. You meant
page 25 is the next.
Yes, that's correct. Sorry.
Any questions on that? Really self-explanatory. The next substantive section is page 27. The disclaimers?
Yes. Page 27 says that nothing about these amendments can be used by anybody to argue for or against sovereignty, Indian country, or that an Elkhorn title is Indian law. We call them neutrality clauses. You can't bootstrap from the amendments.
My question then comes up again about the makeup of the regional councils, and does that not violate this very section merely by saying that we're neutral, but we're then actually going ahead both in federal and state law and imposing that standard? It would seem to me, I think Senator Alford said it best at a couple of our other meetings, that the federal courts have never cared what you call it. It's how you treat it. And that treating it in this fashion, the subject in this fashion, would be a very strong indication of treatment by the state such as to result in either Indian country or sovereignty, and that's what you apparently were attempting to avoid here. I'm only suggesting until we have some legal opinion and discussion on that, we're not going to know whether or not you have been successful in this paragraph.
We've acceded to your request.
Okay, that completes the ANILCA changes. Now, there is a third leg, which is a whole series of statutory changes, but they generally follow the ANILCA changes. And rather than go on through them, the committee has been through them. I'd like to go to public testimony unless there are other questions by members of the committee. If not, we thank you, and we'll go to public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Try to keep it to 5 minutes, but you get extra time for legislative interruptions, legislative disagreement, and all the things that we add to it. So if we start off with Ed Earnhardt. Okay, I was right the first time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ed Earnhardt. I've been a resident of Anchorage in the state for 23 years. My past, I once studied too long, but much of my studying too long was dealing with the U.S. government and the study of the U.S. Constitution and constitutional law. I've never practiced in that area. I'm not a lawyer. I only taught it for a couple of years, but I've kind of kept up. All right, now where I stand on this, I support the task force recommendation. I have deplored for a long time the lack of activity on the part of the Alaska legislature on this subject, but I've known of the pressures they have from special interests in the state, which continue, including, of course, a number of your legislators tell me, well, I'm a member of that organization, or something like that. By the way, I'm a member of very few organizations, but I am a member of one that after their people got out of the city after many, many years, Chamber of Commerce of Anchorage went and visited the Bush, and they came out last year in support of the task force recommendations. They got enlightened, I think, a little bit. Now, I think a general thing that we have to face, we got a presumed constitutional lawyer speaking next, but anyway, the welfare of the people is the chief law, came from a Roman a number of years ago. The U.S. Constitution's preamble says that we're supposed to be concerned with the general welfare. Now, all this nitpicking about provisions in the Constitution that would lead to more strife, would lead to more enmity, that would lead to more nitpicking, would lead to more cheap politics, that would lead to more special interest pressing hard for its bit. This, I don't think, should be, and I think the task force worked hard to try to move toward a settlement of this issue. And I must say, I have no opinion who's the best manager, the state or the federal government, because many times they're both lousy. I had 17 years with the Bureau of Land Management and Land Conveyances, and I know what a mess ANCSA is, and land law. And I know your problems here. What's public land? What's federal land? It's tough, but it's fairly simple to say that the feds are, as the Civil War proved, eventually going to be dominant in deciding finally what does the law mean. States in those days, and they even got together in doing it, were violating human rights. I don't think it's a human rights question, as some people said, or it is a natural law question. But then that's my theory. I don't go with that, but that's okay for people to claim that. But as the preacher said in Palmer Wasilla the other day, that puts it into a moral plane. I want to avoid the moral plane and stick to the practical of Alaskans living together, of Alaskans being able to continue to, get supported by who you've been supported so much. The federal government, without the federal government, all this greatness of Alaska, how we support ourselves and so on, and then we yowl every time they cut down the number of troops in Alaska. It's on the basis of defense, and we're doing our part. Hey, it's economic. Let's get back to some respect for the idea of the courts. Right now, they're trying to tear apart a court in the United States because some of the people who are here, I'm sure, are hoping with the division of the Ninth Circuit, you'll have a greater advantage in pressing your case here for states' rights, for nullification. What you're attempting here is nullification of ANILCA, or part of it, when you hang with that decision of the Alaska Supreme Court and refuse to bend the Constitution of Alaska to fit with federal law. But that, of course, waves a red flag. Federal law, hey, those feds. So anyway, I came here to express my strong feelings and considerable amount of thought, talk. I've talked to lawyers. I've talked to constitutional lawyers. I have studied some more. And as a person who worked in navigability, I know about that mess. And I feel sorry for everybody. The state and the feds continue to fight. And one of the reasons there was states' rights, really. It was stupid of the federal government not to have come into the 20th century and define navigability. But instead, they followed, somebody told me, common law, English law, old common law. And it's on that that people are still making these claims for the arrangements out here of our birds and the hunting of them and of the fishes and the taking of them. Let's come into the 20th century. The federal government, Congress has a lot of power, but I hope they use it right. But the state does not have the power that some people claim, and the feds have shown us a few times. So that's why we're faced with this deadline here coming up, which won't mean anything directly because the feds aren't directly going to do anything. But if you people can piddle to until you come into session, you're going to have more of this crap. You're going to have more of this everybody nitpicking and bringing in the sort of delays. The delays are good for the lawyers. ANCSA was good for the lawyers. And it's not good for the state to not push this to resolution, whether it's the federal takeover or whether it's this. But the federal, you still got the problems if you get the federal takeover of management this coming year. That won't be effective till spring. I understand it'll cost about $40 million to get into it. And that's our money, we could say, because we're part of the United States. And to have duplication of expenditure and to have the confusion we have here is ridiculous. My time up?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I didn't think I'd have any questions. As soon as you get to important issues and stop the nitpicking, you don't have any questions. And I feel sorry for you people to have to do all that nitpicking.
Wayne Ross.
Thank you. My name is Wayne Ross, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this committee. I got down here at noon because I thought I could get in and get out quick if I got my name on the list first, and I've been here 4 hours. So. But it's been very interesting, especially listening to Mr. Malott. He reminds me of a fellow trying to sell a three-legged dog to a duck club. And I specifically enjoyed the questions by the two senators of Mr. Mason. Mr. Mason was asked if that dog could hunt, and Mr. Mason, of course, winged it, ducked the issue, but I'm sure he's going to bill people, if you pardon the pun. I'm a former chairman of the Alaska Land Use Advisors Committee, a Republican National Committee man, an NRA director, and I've lived in Alaska 30 years. We are, in effect, the victims of a carjacking. We've had the federal government stick a gun on our ear and say that he wants to take over our car, i.e. the management of our fish and game. And what has our governor done? Our governor has appointed a task force, which has come up with a recommendation that we should get together and maybe let us drive, but we'll go wherever you want to go, but let us drive our own car. I submit that our governor and our attorney general took an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska. And now, instead of supporting and defending the Constitution of the State of Alaska, our governor proposes to simply change our Constitution and bow to the threats of the Clinton administration. During the process of statehood, Congress ratified these portions of Alaska's Constitution, and you should remember them and read them over because they're very important. Article 1, all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection. All persons. Doesn't say rural persons. Says all persons. Article 1, Section 15, no law making any irrevocable grant of special privileges or immunity shall be passed. Article 8, Section 3, fish and wildlife are reserved to the people for common use. Doesn't say to the rural people. Says to the people. Article 8, Section 17, laws and regulations governing the use of natural resources shall apply equally to all persons. Alaskans chose statehood because statehood would transfer management of fish and wildlife on all lands and waters from federal agencies to the state. And for Representative Williams, in 1971, Congress, the state, and Alaska Natives agreed to Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANSCA, which stated, quote, all Aboriginal titles, if any, and claims of Aboriginal title in Alaska based on use and occupancy, and including any Aboriginal hunting or fishing rights that may exist, are hereby extinguished, unquote. For their waiver of any claims for, quote, Aboriginal title, unquote, and, quote, Aboriginal hunting or fishing rights, unquote, Alaska Natives received $962 million and 44 million acres of land, 15% of the land base of the state of Alaska. The Native Claims Settlement Act stated that this settlement settled all claims, quote, with certainty, unquote, and, quote, without establishing any permanent racially defined rights or privileges, unquote. Now, you might ask, what did we get for $962 million and 44 million acres of land? We got some people coming back to the well for a second drink. And I submit to you that that's improper when other people can't drink at the same well. In 1980, however, under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, Congress included a subsistence priority for rural residents only on national lands and mandated federal management of fish and wildlife on federal lands if Alaska's subsistence law does not conform with ANILCA. In passing ANILCA, Congress ignored Alaska's constitution, a constitution it approved under the statehood compact. Instead of challenging this congressional violation of the statehood compact, the state first opted to go along to get along by enacting subsistence laws providing for a rural preference. In a case brought by several Alaskans, of which I was an attorney for that case, including a native Alaskan who lived in the largest village, native village in Alaska, Tuwit Anchorage, the Alaska Supreme Court held that a rural subsistence preference violated Alaska's constitution. That's the McDowell case. Now, instead of keeping his oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, Governor Knowles now meekly suggests we amend that Constitution to bring Alaska into compliance with ANILCA. Even if the governor were successful, however, there'd still be federal management of fish and game because ANILCA provides that anyone who feels that they're aggrieved can go into federal court and have a federal judge review what we're doing. As long as Section 8 of ANILCA exists, federal courts can review any attempts by the state to manage our fish and game. The only way to resolve this problem is to get Congress to repeal Section 8 of ANILCA or challenge it in court as violative of the statehood compact. These avenues need to be pursued aggressively by the state of Alaska before talking about amending our Constitution. Instead of doing so, however, our governor advocates some sort of vote as to whether urban Alaskans should be required to give up rights granted them by this state's constitution. Such vote will merely pit Alaskan against Alaskan. Instead of a ballot measure, we need to elect a strong governor with the courage to stand up for the rights of all Alaskans to live without undue federal interference. Once that happens, Alaskans of goodwill can work together to solve the subsistence issue on our own. Thank you. I have a copy of my expanded copy that I'll pass on.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. So if you assert, based on your testimony, that it's going to take amendments to four sections of the Constitution to incorporate a rural priority?
To incorporate a rural priority, I don't think we want to incorporate a rural priority. We want to have an equal access. I think what's specifically needed is a removal of Title 8 of ANILCA, or either by Congress or by taking the matter, challenging it in court. And the problem is, of course, we haven't had a governor who will hold our congressional leaders' feet to the fire. We've had a lot of rhetoric about how powerful they are. We've had a lot of rhetoric about how ANILCA can't be amended, yet we've seen it amended time after time when they want to have it amended, and it's a lot easier for them to duck amending ANILCA when we have the legislature on the one hand and the courts on the one hand and the governor on the other, and don't present a united front to them. So I submit to you, we need to present a united front. If the governor won't do it, we need to get rid of that governor and get someone who will, and then we need to challenge it in court by getting an attorney general who has a little moxie and understands what the oath of office means that he takes.
Thank you, Mr. Ross, and I appreciate you waiting so long to testify.
Well, we didn't get any sandwiches or anything.
Nor have I, and nor will I, and I have to stay till 8 o'clock tonight, or 9 o'clock, probably.
Well, I kept thinking about subsistence, and subsistence means eating something.
Well, for me, yesterday, subsistence was penis, and that's not how I define it. Mr. Ross, I appreciate your testimony, and to hear all different sides, I think we need to do that. But I have two questions. One is a question, one is more. You heard me ask Mr. Mallott this morning as to the governor's task force on subsistence. Was this meant to be the answer, or was this a part of a solution to a long-standing dilemma we've been in for many, many years of trying to get out of that? And I think the answer was that the task force was putting this out, not thinking that this was going to be the only proposal. Now, Mr. Ross, as I've chastised this joint committee yesterday very strongly, that it isn't the governor's proposal, but this letter, which you have a copy of, dated September 23rd, says, "We hope we can count on your support." Signed by Gail Phillips, Speaker of the House, Mike Miller, President of the Senate, and the governor and others that were on that committee. So, again, I reiterate that I think that this was comprised of seven people, that you have the leader of both the House and the Senate that is saying, we hope that we have your support. Now, there's been many changes or recommended changes that I can support some of those changes that have been recommended. And I think that's what we have to go through, is to hear public testimony, but I want to get it back to the people to vote on. Now, my question to you is, when, you know, I hear so much of Native, and I guess that when I read this, that I hear rural. Now, I have 91 communities, and I've repeated this before to this committee and others. Those that I represent, and it's half the state geographically, that those are comprised of, I've always said about 50-50, 50% Native, 50% non-Native. I think that we have to come into this subsistence issue as everybody has to give something. We can't divide the state on racial lines. I don't see this as native. I think it was defined as rural. How do you define rural?
I don't define rural except as out in the country. When we used to go for a drive in the farmlands, we went to the rural areas. In my opinion, rural, using the term rural and urban is divisive. When I first came to Alaska, the game regulations provided that if a person needed to use the game resources, they could go out and do it with impunity if they needed it. That was, that's,
Mr. Ross, I mean, the question
that's how
is,
I define subsistence,
right,
as something that's needed, and if it's, and it's probably needed more by the people in the outlying areas.
Well, Mr. Ross, I heard you refer to native, and also on welfare, et cetera. That's why I ask you is, do you define rural then, as we're talking about here, as native, that this is a native subsistence?
Okay, if you remember, Representative Williams was referring to promises that he alleged were made in the settlement of the Native Claims Settlement Act. And he said, why shouldn't we get these people to keep those promises? In my opinion, those promises were kept, and the point that I was attempting to make to Representative Williams and to this body, and perhaps made inartfully, is that there were payments made as part of the Native Claims Settlement Act. And in my opinion now, we shouldn't get into whether or not the natives have any more rights at the present time. That issue settled. The question now comes down to, do the rural areas have any more rights than the urban people? That's the question. And it shouldn't be a racial issue. I thought Representative Williams was bringing that issue in, and that's why I mentioned it.
Representative Ogie? I might follow up on my original question. You know, you quoted four different sections of the Constitution. Let me rephrase it another way. If we adopted the rural property as proposed in the governor's task force, whom the governor appointed all the people to. Anyway,
thank you.
You do believe it would be in violation of three other provisions of the Alaska Constitution?
Having taken McDowell to court, I can assure you that if you pass any part of this, we'll be taking you to court again. And Mr. Mason was unable to come out and tell you whether or not, or perhaps unwilling to come out and tell you whether or not this dog would hunt. But I can assure you it won't, and I'll do my best to give our Supreme Court another kick at the can to point out to you that it won't, and that all Alaskans should be treated equally and have the same rights like our Supreme Court's been trying to say for the last four or five decisions that they've come out with. So, you know, your passing this could be considered a make-work project for me. But I don't need that kind of work. I'd rather have us working together than fighting.
Thank you very much.
Senator Taylor?
Yes, Wayne, thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate your background in this field. There's few others in the state that have spent the amount of time in court actions and research that you have, and you won. You've got to kind of remember that. The other side,
we all won. We all want to know.
Yep. The question I had is that for some reason, I haven't had a clear answer on it yet in 4 days of testimony by the administration concerning their representatives concerning this task force. What other alternatives were available? We're criticized by many for fiddling around or the legislature not doing anything. I can assure you we've been doing a lot for a long time trying to find consensus on this very complex issue, very difficult. But one of the alternatives that I asked Charlie Cole about in front of the Fairbanks Republican Women's Luncheon up there about a month ago or so, and I asked Charlie, I said, Charlie, do you know of any reason why we could not bring a direct action suit before the United States Supreme Court and considering it's challenging the constitutionality of an oath, and considering the current makeup of that court, the recent decisions that truly advocate for states' rights, we just had my Chief Supreme Court Justice seated here in the community in front of 140 judges, where she told us that the states were the incubators of ideas, the federal government should be running over us, and so on. I said, concerning that makeup of our current Supreme Court, do you believe that that direct action suit would have a good chance of prevailing on the issues as you know them? He said, yes. He thought it could. I said, to prevent this moratorium from going into effect and all these other threats, could we not ask the United States Supreme Court for an injunction enjoining the federal agencies from enforcing this federal mandate until such time as they, our Supreme Court, could make a determination on constitutionality so we'd know whether we had to do this or not? And Charlie agreed that that would probably be a good idea. And I just wanted to know that from your background and experience, have you contemplated that as one solution that we might be looking at, and do you feel as Charlie did?
I represented a group of people, several of us represented a group of people that tried to carry on the state's argument in McDowell 2 case in the federal court. The problem that we have is we don't have an administration that's willing to take on the issue for political reasons. They're unwilling to take on the issue. Perhaps they feel that they're going to be alienating their constituency of some kind, or they're not going to get the votes. But in my opinion, if we have an administration that takes that issue up, as you suggested, with the authority of the state behind it, because they're the only ones that can raise the issue, it's a winner. It's a winner. And then we as Alaskans can sit down and solve our own problems without the federal gun being stuck in our ear. But there are certain groups that are happy with the feds running fish and game, and they've been publicly stating it in the paper. And with all due respect to Ms. Lincoln, I think some of those groups are Native groups, okay? They've said they're happy with the feds. And I don't believe the Native peoples themselves are happy with the feds. I think it's the Native leaders who may profess to be happy. But the governor is attempting to protect that constituency, and that's why he doesn't have the guts to take him on in court. And he ought to do it, and he ought to do it now if he's the governor for all Alaskans. Instead, he's created a very divisive issue. We've had people here sat here for 4 hours. Why have they sat here for 4 hours? Because they're very interested in the issue. And he wants them to, he proposes to have a vote in which one group will vote to take away rights from another group. How divisive can you get? It's outrageous that he would suggest that. I've never been called a constitutional attorney before, so I'm glad I stayed for 4 hours, because it was kind of a treat to be called a constitutional attorney. I consider myself a country lawyer, so if I've achieved a greater status, I appreciate it.
Representative Williams, did you have a question?
Yes, I do. I'm glad that I had thoughts on my comments I made earlier. I appreciate your remarks. I did not try to make it a racial issue. What I said is that we negotiated away our rights in 1971 with ANSCA. And I think if you read in that conference report, and again, if you could read the conference report that came down, I guess you know what a conference report is. What the conference report says is that in the property rights of, we did give up our Aboriginal rights. That was a property right. And then further down, it says where we were still negotiating for subsistence. I've talked to several people back that went back and was and followed the ANSCA through, and they said subsistence was part of the negotiations. It was land, money, and subsistence.
Could I ask Representative Williams a question? Who does he mean by we when he says we? Are you talking about Native peoples, or are you talking about rural peoples?
I'm talking about we as the state of Alaska, the United States of America, when they negotiated the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Okay, then we should all have subsistence rights, including myself and my four kids who live in Anchorage.
I would appreciate it if you would look up the conference report and tell me what that means to you. The conference report to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and in that conference report it says the conference committee expects both the secretary and the state to take any action necessary to protect the subsistence needs of the natives. It doesn't say rural people, it says the natives.
So your position is that it's a special for the native peoples?
I'm saying that it was a part of a negotiated settlement in ANSCA. It was part of the settlement. I'm not saying that it was just put in there because some people thought it should be there. It was a negotiated settlement.
Okay, I just read the ANSCA differently than you do, sir, with all due respect.
That's fine. I'd ask you to look at the conference report and get back to me here in Ketchikan. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions?
I have one.
Representative. Wayne, the idea of either repealing Section 8 of ANILCA or taking it to court and holding it inviolate, is that the correct word? Otherwise, invalidating it.
Right. Is that correct? Challenging it.
Would then take the whole subsistence rural priority requirement and that whole federal mandate on us out of the way. That's what you see.
For the time.
And leave it up to us.
In my opinion, it would, and leave it up to us to